This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The verdict is in. Boston mobster James Whitey Bulger guilty on every single count but one of a sweeping 32-count indictment. Racketeering, guilty. Extortion, guilty. Money laundering, guilty. And Bulger was proven responsible in 11 of 19 murder charges. The murders of Paul McGonigal, Deborah Hussey, Michael Donahue, proven. But in the murder of Deborah Davis, the jury's conclusion, no finding. Here's her brother, Stephen Davis, moments after hearing the verdict.
I gotta live every day. And the rest of the families have to live every day with the fact that they lost a loved one.
The jury deliberated for 5 days, bringing to a close a decades-long criminal saga where Bulger went from South Boston underworld boss to FBI informant to one of the nation's most wanted men for the 16 years he was on the run. Up next on Radio Boston, the Bulger verdict, reaction from the courthouse and from you. First, this news.
This podcast is a free service of WBUR. Please help us keep it free. Go to WBUR.org and click donate in the upper right-hand corner. And now back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. My co-host Anthony Brooks is off today. James Whitey Bulger was stoic, but family members of his victims cried as a federal jury handed down its verdict against the infamous Boston mobster. Bulger was found guilty on 31 of 32 counts, including racketeering, extortion, and money laundering. He was also proven responsible in 11 of 19 murder charges today, including the murders of Edward Connors, Thomas King, Deborah Hussey, and Michael Donahue, just to name some of the 11. Donahue's family attended every single day of this trial. Here's his wife, Patricia Donahue, speaking to reporters just moments ago.
I think I cried for myself and I cried for them because we were kind of all in the same situation here.
This is a historic verdict in a monumental case for victims' family members, for law enforcement, and for the city of Boston itself. What do you make of the Bulger verdict? What do you think it means for Boston, for this chapter in the city's history, and how the city moves forward? Give us a call with your thoughts on today's verdict in the case against James Whitey Bulger. Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're going to dive deep into today's verdict, and we're going to do so with reporters at the courthouse, with legal experts and other people associated with this trial and this long-running story. And let's begin with the head of the pack. That is WBUR senior reporter David Boeri. He's at the Moakley Courthouse. Hi there, David.
Hi, Meghna.
So set the scene in the courtroom as the verdict was handed down, David.
2 o'clock. 2 o'clock, the jurors filed into that room. They then stood. The clerk asked them to hearken to the verdict. They passed her their verdict sheet, and in trembling voice, often breaking, the clerk then read the 32 counts and how they'd found. And you said, as you've noted earlier, that they convicted on 30 out of 32 counts. By no means does that indicate at all that this was a slam dunk. In fact, this was a case that was largely uncontested by the defendant, and in the most important toll of all, on the predicate acts of murder, eight murder victims were listed, and of those eight, the juries decided that the government had not proven its case against those eight. And as they told Meghna, the first six were not guilty, not guilty, not guilty, not guilty. The families in that room were absolutely stunned until the seventh murder victim, and then the jurors decided, and then in a long line, that in fact the government had proved its case.
So, David, tell us about the jury's interesting finding in the case of the murder of Deborah Davis. She was Stephen the Rifleman Flemmy, an associate of Whitey Bulger's, his young girlfriend, and yet the jury found no finding in her murder. What does that mean?
It means that the jurors, in some cases, with regard to the testimony of Flemmy, but especially John Martorano, in this case by Flemmy, her ex-boyfriend, the jurors found those government witnesses not believable. In the case of Davis, they found they could not come to a consensus, not proven or proved, so they just moved on. But in that case, there were only two people there, Whitey Bulger and Stephen Flemmy. They both pointed at each other, and the jury clearly decided that Flemmi's word was not good enough for them in that situation.
Hmm. Now, David, in the many of the extortion charges, James Whitey Bulger was found guilty or that proven responsible, including the extortion of Stephen Rakes, who was killed in an unrelated case or action not that long ago. He had hoped to testify in this case. He didn't ever get that chance. What do you make of the fact that Bulger was found responsible for the extortion of Stephen Rakes?
Well, here they found again that the witnesses were credible in what they presented, and they decided to go with what they had been presented, although they had problems with some of those witnesses. You know, as soon what was uncontested, whatever had happened between Rakes and his wife and Bulger and Weeks, the clear thing that the jury decided on was that when Rakes decided he wasn't sure whether he was going to sell, the gun went on the table.
David, meaning what?
I'm sorry. I'm hearing J.W. Carney outside. I presume that you have that. What we go back to the Rakes case. Basically, they decided that when that gun went on the table, there was no question. When the gun went on the table after Rakes balked, that was extortion. And so they came to that verdict. But I want to go back, Deb, to what I think is a significant part of this, and that is that that jury rejected the credibility of John Martorano, a key government witness here, in those early murders. And it was stunning in the courtroom to see the crushing look on those families of the victims that had been here thinking that, in fact, they were going to see a conviction. There was Connie Leonard, whose father was murdered. There were the Milano family.
David, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but stand by for just a second, because we do have James Whitey Bulger's lawyer, J.W. Carney, speaking to reporters outside the courtroom right now. Looks like he's just, in fact, stepping away from the microphone. So I'll continue. I'm sorry, David. When he steps back to the mic, we'll go back to him. But continue your thought about the emotion amongst the victims' families.
Well, of Bulger's early families, there was Tommy Notarangeli, his father Alfred Notarangeli, murdered. He just was beside himself. He couldn't believe it. Connie Leonard, the father of Buddy Leonard, was crying outside, saying, "This is just so unfair. It's so unfair." She pointed to the fact that after Bulger, now we can say no longer alleged, but after Bulger killed Tommy King that same day, he is alleged to have then killed her father, Buddy Leonard. In fact, Buddy Leonard's body was found in Tommy King's car, and the testimony was that what Bulger had done is he had killed King, buried King, and then set it up to look like King had murdered Leonard and left town, and he did that through his FBI handler.
Yeah.
Miss Leonard was just beside herself, as were so many of those early victims in the courtroom.
David, stand by. We're going to go now to J.W. Carney, the attorney, one of the attorneys for James Whitey Bulger, speaking live outside the Moakley Courthouse in South Boston.
I think the local rule that prevents contact with the media and others once a trial begins is overly restrictive. That's particularly true in the federal court, where there aren't cameras in the courtroom. I wish that every citizen who wanted to would have been able to watch this trial on television or on an iPad or on a laptop. They would have seen things that would educate them about the federal government, that would amaze them, shock them, appall them, and just make them realize there has to be changes. When the cameras can't be in the courtroom, then it's incumbent upon lawyers to be able to come in front of the courthouse and speak on behalf of their client. It's very frustrating, and I hope that the rule will be changed.
Jay, if you could draw a lesson about informants, what might that be, the whole lesson of informants, government informants?
I think the use of informants is a dangerous practice. The government will offer people, in essence, bribes, not by money, but by something more valuable, freedom. And if they offer enough freedom, to certain witnesses, I guarantee they will say anything, whether it's the truth or not the truth.
That's J.W. Carney, the lawyer, one of the attorneys for James Whitey Bulger. David, we just heard, I'm speaking with WBR senior reporter David Boyer, who's also at the Moakley Courthouse. David, we just heard Carney talk about informants and government informants. Right. What do you make of what he said?
Right. What he's doing right there, Magda, is reprising his closing argument. They divided the closing argument, the two lawyers, the two defense lawyers. Carney talked about doubt and the reason for reasonable doubt that the jurors should have, while Hank Brennan talked about the government's conduct, or more to the point, misconduct here. They made a huge point about these deals with Martorano and Weeks and Flemmi that they called unconscionable, that they called a virtual form of buying testimony. And clearly, there was nobody that exemplified the deal more than John Martorano, a man who admitted to killing 20 people, murdering 20 people. He served less than 12 and a half years in prison. He got $20,000 walkie money when he got out. He has a $250,000 deal to make a movie in Hollywood that'll bring another $500,000. He got deal after deal after deal with the government. They said that the only thing worse then making the deal with him would have been not to make the deal with him, but you saw in stark terms with John Martorano what was going on here, and the fact that the jury here has come back with 7 not provens and 1 not sure is a testimony to Martorano and his lack of credibility in his testimony about those murders with that jury.
David, I must ask you, you have been following this case and this story for decades. You've spoken with the family members of victims. You've spoken with very close associates of Bulger over these many years. For you, what does today signify in the story of South Boston and in Boston in general?
This trial, unfortunately, is far smaller than it might have been. We looked at this trial as a hope or a possibility or an opportunity for a full accounting of what went on here. But because of the judge that was involved, because of the approach by the Department of Justice and by these prosecutors, what we have is a narrow trial. This trial, and not to sound naive, because the defendant here is James Whitey Bulger. But the problem with this trial is that it was all about James Whitey Bulger, and it wasn't about the bigger issues. James Whitey Bulger, Magna, was a small man that was made a giant by government policy, by the FBI, by corruption, cover-up, and cowardice. And so here you have a situation where we could have had a much bigger trial. It wasn't that.
WBUR senior reporter David Boyer speaking to us live from the Moakley Courthouse. David, thank you so much for your reporting on this, and we look forward to continue hearing you as the details unfold following today's verdict. Thank you, David.
You're welcome.
Once again, listeners, we are talking about the jury's verdict against Boston mobster James Whitey Bulger. He was found guilty on all counts but one in a sweeping 32-count federal indictment against him, including found responsible in 11 of 19 murders. It is a major moment in Boston's history. We want to know what you think about this case and about the verdict. Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Stick with us for now, because when we come back, we'll talk to a retired federal judge about what she makes about today's verdict. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. We'll be right back. This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about the verdict, which was handed down against Boston mobster James Whitey Bulger just a couple hours ago. He was found guilty on 31 of 32 criminal counts, including money laundering, racketeering, conspiracy, and found responsible in 11 of 19 murder charges as well. Just a few moments ago, Bulger's defense attorney, J.W. Carney, spoke to reporters outside the Moakley Courthouse and reported what he said was Bulger's response to the trial.
No, I'm not satisfied with the verdict. I'm very satisfied with him being guilty of my dad's murder. Absolutely. Don't get me wrong. But there were other things he should have been found guilty on. There are some families out there who've been hurting, just like I have, and now they're never even going to have a chance for closure because they couldn't come up, you know, with a guilty verdict.
That was actually Tommy Donahue, if I may correct myself. Tommy Donahue, who's the son of Michael Donahue, one of the murder victims that Bulger was found responsible for today. Again, that was Tommy Donahue. Here is tape from J.W. Carney, Bulger's attorney, who again is giving what he says is Bulger's response to this trial just a few hours ago.
Jim Bulger was very pleased at how the trial went and even pleased by the outcome. I don't think he expected that nine times the jury would come back and say not guilty or not proven. It was important to him that the government corruption be exposed, and important to him that people see firsthand the deals that the government was able to make with certain people. With that as what he was looking for from a trial, he's very pleased.
Well, there you hear Bulger's defense attorney, J.W. Carney, saying his client, Whitey Bulger, is very pleased with the outcome of this trial. Does that make sense to you? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK with your reaction to this historic case against James Whitey Bulger. Let's turn now to a very experienced voice who's got a lot of time in a courtroom. She is Nancy Gertner. She is a retired federal judge and currently a Harvard Law School professor. Judge Gertner, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
It's great to have you. First of all, tell us your reaction to the verdict, 31 out of 32 counts guilty, 11 of 19 murder charges. What do you make of how the jury found?
Well, since so much of the case was admitted to by the defendant, it's not a surprise that the vast majority of the counts came up with a guilty verdict. The length of time that the jury took is also not a surprise, with a verdict slip that is as complex as this. And I take what David Boeri said a moment ago, that you know, this is a jury that was literally sifting through the evidence and not believing some of the government's witnesses, and in context, believing others. So it was, it seems to me it's a careful verdict to a carefully done trial.
Mm. A little earlier today, before there was an announcement of a verdict, the jury came back into the courtroom with a question for Judge Denise Casper, essentially asking if on some of the counts, if they could find, or would it be possible to find Bulger basically guilty by association if they believed that someone else had actually committed the crime? That seemed to be kind of a complicated question that took Judge Casper and attorneys on both sides quite some time to respond to. They gave a 3-page response to the jurors that seemed to, I guess, settle the situation, because an hour or two later we had a verdict. What do you make of the sort of detailed nature of that question and how the jury, what it tells us about how the jury deliberated?
Well, it says something very good about the jury, in the sense that the jury is sifting through not just the facts, but also trying to come up with what is perhaps the most complicated concept in criminal law, which is, you know, accomplice liability. When is someone standing next to the shooter responsible? When is a co-conspirator responsible for the acts of somebody else? That's really, I can tell you from teaching the subject and doing the subject, that's the hardest part of criminal law. And it's very impressive that they chose to do that. But if we could step back for a moment, the government had two alternatives in addressing Whitey Bulger. One was dealing with the plethora of civil cases that had been brought against the government based on government cooperation with Bulger and other informants. And as to those, the government took a rather consistent position, denying liability and seeking to get out from under those cases through technical arguments, which they were entitled to make, but nevertheless technical arguments. Those cases, had they gone to trial, would have been subject to a lower standard than the criminal standard. The plaintiffs in those cases only had to prove their case by a fair preponderance of the evidence, more likely than not.
Mm.
But by going ahead with the criminal case, the standard now, of course, is the appropriate standard, which is beyond a reasonable doubt.
Judge Gertner, if I could ask you to stand by for just a moment, I want to briefly bring into this conversation Michael Patrick McDonald. He's the author of All Souls, A Family Story from Southie. He's a South Boston native. He's been following this case very closely. He is in Germany today, and he joins us now on the line. Michael Patrick McDonald, welcome back to the show.
Hello, good to be here.
So first of all, your reaction to today's basically all guilty except for one count verdict against James Bolger.
Well, I feel the same day I felt when the trial began, which was that, on the first day of the trial, the defense acknowledged Bolger's role in bringing the drugs into South Boston. Most of what I've been involved in is dealing with the fact that this is a neighborhood that was extremely vulnerable, a poor neighborhood. The lower end of Southie held the highest concentration of white poverty in America, an extremely vulnerable neighborhood of single-parent, female-headed households. They were preyed upon not just by Bolger, but by his colluders in the government.
Mm.
And on the first day, we got the acknowledgement that he was bringing the drugs into Southie, and we heard a lot of evidence that, you know, how much of the drugs were coming into South Boston, that he brought all the cocaine in, and that he made a fortune from those drugs. Now, South Boston, for throughout the 70s, 80s, 90s, and into the 2000s, has held the city's highest death rate from drug overdoses. Whatever happened today has nothing to do with what we really need, which is accountability, so that this kind of thing doesn't happen to other neighborhoods, so that kind of collusion doesn't happen to other vulnerable neighborhoods.
But Michael Patrick McDonald, if I may ask, I'm sorry to interrupt, but as you note, the jury found that James Whitey Bolger was proven that he was responsible for narcotics distribution or a conspiracy to distribute narcotics. That's his racketeering act number 29 in the indictment. Is that even the beginnings of accountability to you?
Well, the thing is, I mean, the narrative of the trial, of course, has been limited to one bad guy. And so the government, as we all saw throughout this entire trial, has kept that narrative very limited. And so people like myself, as well as some of the victims, the other families who've lost people to more direct hits than my family and my neighbors who lost people to all the drug trade and the crimes that our family members got involved in at very young ages, involved in the drug trade in South Boston. A lot of times we were rooting for the defense, and we were rooting for the defense because we were hoping for bigger truths to come out. And I don't think that we'll ever see those truths about the extent of collusion that existed. And the other thing that we don't talk about very much is the legacy, which is ongoing in South Boston. South Boston has the highest admission to hospitals for painkillers, for opiates, for heroin and OxyContin. And, you know, people take painkillers, I think, because they're in pain. And, of course, this has everything to do with the legacy of the Bolger years we all grew up in, where we all lost someone to violence, especially in the lower end in the housing projects, lost people to violence and crime and drugs.
Michael Patrick McDonald, stand by for just a moment. Let's turn back live to the Moakley Courthouse, where U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz is speaking.
...in this town, but it also allowed him to slip away when honest law enforcement was closing in. I hope that the victims, the families, and many others who suffered tremendously, and in some cases were actually destroyed by James Bolger's criminal actions, will take some solace in the fact that he will spend the rest of his life in prison, far away from the beaches of Santa Monica and far from the streets of South Boston. I would like to thank the jurors. You know, they've been sitting on this trial for a long time, for over 2 months, and listening to very long and at times incredibly disturbing testimony. But they listened carefully, they followed their oath, and today they rendered a just verdict based on the evidence. Now, while they did not find that we have proven all of the racketeering acts that we were charged, and we were disappointed in that, we nonetheless fully respect their verdict. With the conviction of James Bolger, we hope that we stand here today to mark the end of an era that was very ugly in Boston's history. While this case has provided a view of some of the worst criminal conduct imaginable. It also outlined for us behavior by law enforcement officials that has ever been seen. Actions that were taken and actions that were not taken by corrupt federal agents, state and local police, led to deplorable behavior by those that knew better, those that we held in a position of trust. Yet despite this corruption, we stand here today because of the dogged work of honest and dedicated members of law enforcement. I want to thank and highlight the work of the Massachusetts State Police, and in particular, Steve Johnson, as well as Dan Daugherty of the DEA. It was through their dedication and their desire to see this case through so many years that it's a tribute to their professional integrity. And working alongside the prosecution team of Assistant U.S. Attorneys Fred Wyshak, Brian Kelly, and more recently, Zachary Hafer, and with the help of Sandy Lamette.
That's U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz speaking live outside the Moakley Federal Courthouse. On the line with me is Michael Patrick McDonald, author of All Souls, A Family Story from Southie. He's a South Boston native. And also Nancy Gertner, former retired, I should say, federal judge as well. Michael Patrick McDonald, I know we have to let you go here in just a second, but react to what you just heard Carmen Ortiz say. She's basically saying that while she doesn't condone some of the actions of the corrupt law enforcement officials associated with this case, she thinks that it also highlights the good that law enforcement has done, and she hopes it brings a very terrible chapter in South Boston's history to a close. What do you make of that, Michael Patrick McDonald?
Well, you know, if we get to greater truths out of it, if we were given the opportunity to get to greater truths, we might be able to prevent those tragedies from happening to other communities. I mean, this is something that has a legacy in South Boston to this day in terms of the drug use in that neighborhood. And the multi-generational trauma that exists there, and you know, throughout the Southie diaspora, I would say. But besides that, how do we prevent this from happening to other vulnerable communities? How do we prevent that collusion from happening? In order to know how to prevent it from happening, we need to know the truth of what exactly happened. And this trial does not give us that.
Michael Patrick McDonald, author of All Souls, A Family Story from Southie. He's speaking to us today from Germany. Michael Patrick McDonald, thank you so much for making the time to be with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Judge Gertner, let me turn back to you. Obviously, this is a, you know, for those of us who are not South Boston natives, it's easy to say that this is a, you know, an end of a chapter or a closing of this portion of the city's history. But for people who still live there, you heard Michael Patrick McDonald say that it's not so simple. There's still so many unanswered questions.
Well, again, it's so important to step back. I appreciate what Carmen Ortiz said about the law enforcement officers who were responsible for this. But it took an extraordinary set of hearings and an extraordinary judge to finally break this open. It is amazing that Judge Wolf's name has not been mentioned in this coverage, but for his hearings, but for his findings, none of this would have happened. And so when you step back and you say how long it took, what kind of extraordinary actions it took to finally unpack this, then you do have to examine how it could have existed so long and what steps we need to take going forward so it doesn't take, you know, a 2.5-year hearing and a 600-page decision, which was Judge Wolf's decision, in order to expose this kind of misconduct. The system did not correct itself, and I'm not persuaded going forward that it will continue to do so.
What do you, if we can step back to something we heard a little earlier in this hour, where James Bulger's attorney, J.W. Carney, talked about the gag order that was essentially put on the defense team and preventing them from talking to the media over the course of this trial. He railed against that once again this afternoon. I mean, now that the trial is over, what do you make of that?
Well, that's actually, I think that's a very important point to make. By the time the trial began, there had been years and years and decades of Bulger coverage. The government announces his arrest with, you know, constant press conferences, 24/7 news coverage. The government announces the investigation, likewise with lots of coverage. The government then announces the charges with lots of coverage. Then once the trial begins, everyone has to be silent. The government didn't have to speak any longer. it had done its speaking over the previous years. So while I appreciate the concern about comments made while there is a sitting jury, I think that we have to look again at the way we deal with that. A total bar on a lawyer, for example, recounting what had gone on in the courtroom may be too far, but we have to look at it again. Because really, as I said, I've seen this over and over again. By the time the trial begins, the government has said all it needed to say. It's only the defense that is new and that the public doesn't know about. Now, to be sure, had there been cameras in the courtroom, perhaps this discussion would have been unnecessary. There was a live feed from one courtroom to the next, as I understand it, and if the cameras doing that live feed did not disrupt the courtroom, I can't imagine how a broader feed would have.
And Judge Gertner, before I let you go, I believe we've been told that James Whitey Bulger will next appear in court for sentencing on November 13th, quite some time from now. What happens between now and then? I mean, the charges that he's been convicted on carry a life sentence.
Right. The amount of time is the time it takes for the probation department, which is really quite excellent, to do a pre-sentence investigation. They will put together all the information they can find about him. They will then do a calculation under the federal sentencing guidelines. The lawyers will look at what they've done to decide whether or not it's accurate or not and interpose objections where appropriate, and then there may be sentencing memoranda. Given the length of these charges and, you know, given the length of Mr. Bulger's life, candidly, this is going to take some time. It's not enough to say we know that on the charges that he's convicted, he's vulnerable to a life sentence. It's also not enough to say that at someone his age, really, a decade is already a life sentence. The judge has to consider all of this carefully and look at what's the appropriate sentence. There should never be anything automatic about sentencing, and I think that that's the reason for the time.
Nancy Gertner is a retired federal judge and current professor at the Harvard Law School. Judge Gertner, always a pleasure to hear from you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Listeners, we are talking about the verdict that was handed down today against Boston mobster James Whitey Bulger. He was found guilty on 31 of 32 criminal counts. He was also found proven responsible in 11 of 19 murder charges. What do you make of the Bulger verdict? What's your reaction to it? We've heard talk this hour already about the fact that many people in South Boston think that not enough questions were answered or not enough investigation went into the government's role in the Bulger story. What do you make of that? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. When we come back, we'll take some of those calls and hear from more legal experts and live from the Moakley Courthouse as well. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. We'll be right back. This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about the jury's verdict handed down just this afternoon against Boston mobster James Whitey Bulger. Once again, he was found guilty on 31 of 32 counts in a sweeping indictment against him. Guilty of racketeering, guilty of money laundering, guilty of extortion. He was also found proven responsible, I should say, in 11 of 19 murder charges, including the murder of Paul McGonigal, Edward Connors, Thomas King, Richard Castucci, Roger Wheeler, just to name a few. There were two women amongst those murder charges. One was Deborah Hussey. Bulger was found proven responsible for her murder. And Deborah Davis. The jury found no finding in the case of Deborah Davis. Here's how Stephen Davis, brother of Deborah Davis, reacted to that just this afternoon, moments after the verdict was handed down.
Why? You know, just the whys. You know, he had everything anybody in this whole audience would want. He had the money. He had enough money to live on an island somewhere by himself. And he chose, it greed.
Once again, that was Stephen Davis, brother of Deborah Davis, a murder victim whose murder was amongst the 32-count indictment that was the findings were made. A verdict was handed down today against James Whitey Bulger. So, listeners, what do you make of that question of why? And what do you think this means for Boston, for how the city moves forward from a criminal chapter in its history, which seemed to hang over the city for so long? Do you think this is Boston's way of moving past the shadow of James Whitey Bulger? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Let's go right to Peter, who's calling from Cambridge. You're on the air, Peter.
Hello. I think it is an end of an era in two respects. One is, I mean, my background's history and policy, so I'm always sort of looking at this. When you look back at the 19th and the early and mid-20th century, how these criminal establishments, you know, could evolve and then change. And where we are at this point now, where you have this stunning jury who has done this, I wonder if 30 years ago this jury could have done this. Could, say, you look back at the, you know, civil rights period in the 60s, there were scads of trials, you know, of tremendous criminality, and people were let off all the time. Mm. And I find it absolutely fascinating that this jury, because they really, in a sense, I think, they end this era. It, you know, it doesn't mean there isn't going to be criminality in the future. Of course, there is. But this seems an incredible step to me.
Peter, thank you so much for your call. Let's turn now to Donald Stern. He's a former U.S. attorney from Massachusetts. He served from 1993 to 2001, and he was U.S. attorney in Massachusetts when James Bulger was indicted as he was on the run. Donald Stern, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hello.
Hi, Donald Stern. Are you there?
I am. Yeah, I had someone was at the door. Hold on, I'm here.
Okay. I'd like to just first ask you what your response is to today's verdict.
Well, I think it's a big win and a very satisfying win. I think for the prosecutors and investigators who worked literally decades to bring James Bulger to justice, and I think it's an important trial for Boston. You know, when he was caught, some people said, you know, what's the point of the trial? He's going to be found guilty. He's not going to be found guilty. He's 83. You know, I think it was important, as difficult as it was sometimes to hear the testimony, and as tempting as it was to sometimes think it was ancient history in Boston, I think it was a very important trial for the city. And I think the result was the, you know, I'm disappointed that they didn't come back guilty on all counts. But having said that, 31 of 32 counts ain't bad.
Donald Stern, a little earlier this hour, we heard from WBR senior reporter David Boeri, who he's been following this case for as long as anybody. And he said that one drawback or maybe not so positive outcome is that he believes a full accounting wasn't given, that the trial was actually overly narrowed because it's so acutely focused on Bulger himself. What's your reaction to that?
You know, I think there's probably something to that. You know, the criminal justice system and a criminal trial of an individual defendant is not always the best forum, the best mechanism for the big picture facts to come out. I mean, that's the way the system works. It's what's relevant for these charges. It's what's legally permissible to raise as a defense for this defendant. So, you know, that's always the case, that the jury hears those facts that are constrained by the rules of evidence and constrained by what's relevant for particular charges. And it's a, you know, often litigants or jurors will say, well, you know, the jury didn't get the complete picture. They didn't get the full historical flow. So there's something to that. Having said that, I think the jury are heard an awful lot. I think they heard, you know, the good, bad, and the ugly. They heard the some of the very difficult deals that were made with hardened criminals to get to justice, to get to this day. They heard about some of the law enforcement corruption. And I think most importantly, they heard about the very chilling, and it's hard to find a kind word for this, evil acts on the part of the defendant. You know, that was laid out in chapter and verse for the jury to hear. Mm.
Donald Stern, former U.S. attorney for Massachusetts, who served from 1993 to 2001. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. All right.
Let's turn now to John Red Shea. He's a former drug runner for James Whitey Bulger and author of the book Rat Bastards, The Story of South Boston's Most Honorable Irish Mobster. John Red Shea, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I understand that you at one time saw Whitey Bulger as a father figure, and you felt deeply betrayed by him since then. What is your reaction to today's verdict?
I mean, I was the youngest of everybody involved at the time. And that said, I kind of looked up at to all of these guys one way or another as a older brother or a father figure. You know, I knew that it was going to be... he was going to be found guilty. I knew that the evidence was overwhelming. And it's kind of poetic justice in a way. It's quite not the justice that I would prefer, so to speak. And I'll tell you why. Today marks the anniversary weekend, and today marks the anniversary for me on when the day I was indicted and sent to federal prison on charges and him knowing the investigation prior to that and not telling me about it and letting me take the fall for him. That said, it's also my birthday.
Wow, so a major day for you on so many fronts.
John,
tell us, I mean, for people who don't know your story in detail, tell us a little bit about specifically, you know, how you knew Bulger and what you did for him.
Well, as a young kid growing up in the projects and growing up in South Boston, I got involved in criminal activities. I started hanging out with the older guys in the neighborhood that were associated with him. And I didn't have a father figure at home, so I kind of looked at these guys as bigger brothers and a father figure. And I seen the money that they were making, the power that they wielded, and even at this time, I was a good boxer growing up. Boxing wasn't making a lot of money for me. But these guys had a lot of money, and I didn't have money. I didn't come from anything. And I saw them, and I saw that it was kind of like it was okay to do it. And they were respected. So I kind of fell in line to that and wanted to be like that. And I rose to the ranks of... surpassed most of these guys and rose to the ranks of being a boss at one time for the drug organization.
Mm. What do you think, I mean, are there, from your, sorry for stumbling here a little, there's so many questions I could ask you. I'm wondering, what do you think, if there are any lessons for people in South Boston today based on what happened today and lessons from your own life?
Absolutely. And I wrote a second book about that, and it's called The Kid from Southie. And that's to deter young kids that are growing up in a similar environment that I grew up in and today, some environments, into curbing themselves and saying no to and getting involved in this type of activity, but and being able to hold their head up high and make a better life for themselves. My life has definitely changed, and I'm very humble about that and thankful for that. That my life has changed, and now I'm a full-fledged author with two books and a third book on the way. I mean, it is what it is, you know, growing up as a young man at that time in that environment. And I'm not saying it was right, but as one person had once said, you know, John did not do anything wrong. He did everything right that he was taught.
Mm. Now, John Shea, before I let you go, I have to ask you one more question. I've heard that you've said you used to have a recurring dream that you would see in your dream Whitey Bulger on the street and you'd snap his neck in this dream. Do you think after today, do you hope those dreams will stop?
I hope so, but they have occurred just recently, and it's something that I live with.
Well, John Shea, former drug runner for James Whitey Bulger and author of the book Rat Bastards, The Story of South Boston's Most Honorable Irish Mobster, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Let's turn now to Pamela Hay, retired U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency special agent and the only woman on the Bulger Task Force from 2000 to 2005. She now teaches investigative research at Boston University. Pamela Hay, welcome to you.
Thank you.
So you've got yet another perspective on this decades-long story of James Whitey Bulger and Boston. What's your reaction to today's, guilty on 31 of 32 counts verdict that the jury handed down?
This truly is a victory, especially for all of the law enforcement officials involved in the case, for all the law enforcement officials who worked the fugitive case as I did. This was a man who vowed he would never go back to jail. So really, this is the ultimate.
The ultimate. Now, what do you make of what's some of the way the jury found inside this very sweeping list of counts and charges? For example, we heard a little earlier from author Michael Patrick McDonald, who has been long focused on the narcotics distribution charge. James Boulder was today found proven responsible for narcotics distribution conspiracy. You're a former DEA agent. How much does that particular finding matter to you?
You know, that was a big victory for us. DEA investigated Boulder. He was a DEA, indicted by the DEA and the state police. He was a DEA fugitive. So having that count come down and him found guilty on that was amazing and very validating for us.
So take me back to when you were on the Boulder Task Force from 2000 to 2005. I mean, remind us what it was like back then. We're all caught up right now in the moment that happened today at the courthouse, but it took years to get here. So what was it like day in and day out for you on those many years that Boulder was on the lam?
It was a busy time, and I didn't get onto the fugitive case until 2000, so I had a lot of catching up to do because Boulder became a fugitive in 1996. So reading a history of files regarding Boulder and getting to know him the best I could was very important to proceed with the fugitive case. And I did want to mention that there was a new group working this fugitive investigation. It wasn't the old law enforcement era of John Conley. These were a new group of agents that were assigned to the case and were working hard and diligently to find him.
U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz just a little while ago mentioned the same thing, that despite the fact that this case brought up the sordid history of several corrupt federal law enforcement officials, that many other law enforcement officials who came on later are the ones who brought this to a close, essentially. Do you think that today's verdict basically removes any lingering doubt or criticism of Boston law enforcement officials, you know, over the years and decades that have been associated with the Boulder case?
Well, I think the truth came out during the trial, and the bad agents in the FBI were exposed, and the mistakes were exposed, and hopefully everybody can move ahead and look to the future. The difficult part about working the fugitive case and being assigned with, as a DEA agent, with agents from the FBI, it was almost like working undercover in a way, going into that environment, trying to figure out, does this crew really want to find Boulder? So I was in a very challenging position working on that fugitive task force.
Mm. And do you think that going forward, what are the lessons that law enforcement have learned from this long saga and from today's verdict?
Well, I think when an instance like this happens, agencies may look at their informant policy and try to revamp it a bit. Everybody learns from their lessons and tries to tweak and change things. So hopefully moving forward, law enforcement agencies will look at their informant policies and possibly make some changes so this doesn't happen in the future.
Well, Pamela Hay, retired U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency special agent. She was the only woman on the Boulder Task Force from the years 2000 to 2005. She now teaches investigative research at Boston University. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, listeners, just a couple hours ago, a jury handed down its verdict against Boston mobster James Whitey Boulder. Just to recap, of the 32 counts, they found Boulder guilty on 31 of them, so just about every single count. Racketeering, guilty. Money laundering, guilty. Extortion, guilty. There were 19 murder charges in this indictment. He was found proven responsible in 11 of them, including the murder of Paul McGonigal, Edward Connors, Thomas King, Richard Castucci, Roger Wheeler, Brian Halloran, Michael Donahue, John Callahan, and many others. So a major chapter in Boston's history. Coming to at least a partial close today at the Moakley Federal Courthouse. The jury deliberated for almost 5 days. They came back this afternoon with an interesting and complicated question for the judge, which got a lot of people wondering if we were going to see a verdict. An hour or so after that, we did. James Whitey Bulger will now next appear in federal court on November 13th, for his sentencing. Stick with WBUR for now, because we'll have more coverage of this major story on All Things Considered. Let us know what you think about the story at RadioBoston.org. Thanks for listening this hour. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.